Welcome to Nitro Game Injection, KNGI.org. What's up? I am Larry OG from OC Remix. I'm joined by Kyle, JCRB, Kyle Krause. How you doing, man?
Hey, Larry. What's up?
Oh, man, we got some good stuff, man. You're, as usual, you're lining it up big for NGI. So, you know, we're going to be talking with one of the most prolific video game music reporters, journalists, as it were, interviewers in the scene. So, we're looking to have some good stuff on NGI once again.
Yep, we're here with Jerry Aska.
He's a video game music journalist. He runs a site, Nobuo, and you've talked to many game composers.
Yeah, it's really good to be on the program. I've really been enjoying the recent installments.
Well, yeah, welcome to the show. I mean, you just emailed us and wanted to talk about your some of your game composer interview experiences. So well, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved with being a video game journalist, talking with the other composers, and like who you've worked with before?
Well, I started out writing synopses of video game albums for a fan site called Squarehaven, and this was a few years ago. Squarehaven had its own game album database, which was created by someone named Paul Lee, and they had all the great Square soundtracks there, but they didn't have a lot of information on the specifics of each of the titles. And I liked the database, and I started emailing in, you know, brief synopses, like Einhander is a side-scrolling 2D shooter. It has music by Kenichiro Fukui. And eventually they emailed me back and asked me to start writing reviews. And that's how I started as a game journalist. After I'd done some news items and reviews for Squarehaven, I was really interested in getting some more feedback from people who'd actually worked on the production end of Square Games, and that's when I started contacting some voice actors that had worked on Final Fantasy, and that was the first time I'd done interviews for games.
When did you first discover video game music as a, and take it seriously as a hobby?
In junior high and high school is when I was really getting into video game music. Previously, I'd played a lot of games and was really into Japanese role-playing games. And when I was studying for exams in school, which was something that occupied a lot of my time in high school, and is kind of one of my big regrets, is that I gave it so much of a priority. But what I was doing while I was making all these flashcards and studying them in order to keep my sanity was I was listening to these video game music albums that I'd found. I'd found someone that actually imported game soundtracks, and so I would listen to, like, you know, the soundtrack to Secret of Mana or Final Fantasy VI, you know, just repeatedly memorize all the melodies, and that really kind of inspired my present day appreciation for the medium of video game music.
So you said when you were around the time, kind of high school, early college, like that was more what the Super Nintendo era, kind of, late NES, Super NES, or
when I was in junior high and high school was the SNES.
Ah, okay.
And I don't think I would really be able to listen to NES music to the extent that I was able to listen to, like, the Final Fantasy VI soundtrack. For me, that's when it got really, really epic and involving.
You were kind of mentioning. You know, how you got kind of the import hookup and things like that. But let's go maybe a little bit earlier, though. What kind of first put video game music on your radar as you were alluding to?
Sure. Earlier than that, the original Final Fantasy and Dragon Warrior, it was called.
Yeah, Dragon Quest. Right?
It's Dragon Quest.
Right. Dragon Quest came out as Dragon Warrior. And yeah. Final mm-hmm. Fantasy 1 came out as Final Fantasy. Those games were really rich and involving, and you know, you could spend weeks kind of progressing through the story and leveling up your characters. And of course, the music for those games was so memorable and really kind of immediately put you into the feeling of being in that setting and that story. Also, the Capcom games from the NES era had some incredible music that, you know, OC Remix still arranges to great effect. Of course, the Mega Man games, but not only that, like, all of their Disney-licensed games.
Absolutely.
Yes,
had incredible
definitely.
Music. DuckTales, Chip and Dale, Rescue Rangers.
That was my cut, Chip and Dale. Don't hate... No hate on it, man. Chip and Dale was excellent.
It really was.
I never played DuckTales as much, dude. But I played Chip and Dale. I bought that game over Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1 on the Nintendo. And I regretted it until I actually sat down at a friend's house and played Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and realized it was brutally hard and awful.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But by that same token, the Ninja Turtles games is another example of a great company with
Konami,
great composers,
that's right.
Konami, yeah. So
doing a great soundtrack.
I think between Capcom, Konami, Square, and Enix, and Nintendo, of course, those were probably the top musical companies back in the NES era.
Yeah.
What
do you mean, no Sega in there? I'm joking. All right, go ahead.
Hey, the NES. NES.
I know. No, you definitely qualified that.
People could actually beat Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. I didn't know anyone who could beat the original Ninja Turtles.
Right.
It was pretty brutal. Not in my age range.
Mm-hmm. And actually, let me, kind of following up on that, right? So, you know, in the SNES era, you were getting a taste of these albums. You know, you were kind of listening to it on a more official level. So when did you first kind of become cognizant of the fact that there were people creating this music, and what, you know, when did you first kind of discover, oh, Nobuo Uematsu, you know, and the like, and start really getting interested in the personalities behind the music?
I guess that was also in the Super Nintendo era. I wasn't really too aware of, you know, who was making the games back in the NES era, mm-hmm. because my main kind of portal to game design back in the early days was Nintendo Power. So, you know, I was thinking like Howard Phillips was creating video games back then. I didn't really have an in-depth knowledge of, you know, what role Japan was playing. I guess in high school, that's when I started studying Japanese. And that's when I started looking into who was creating this music. And of course, that's very valuable information, because when you find out that, say, Uematsu is the one behind Final Fantasy IV and VI, you can then look into Front Mission Gun Hazard, you know, the other games that he made during that period that are more obscured, you know,
mm-hmm.
more obscure.
Now, let's kind of skip ahead a little bit, though, right? Obviously, you know, you have your stuff where you're involved in futurism, so you do a lot of, you know, photography, a lot of journalism on that level.
That's
and
right.
Now, where did you first get the idea, though, on video game music as well, to start kind of pursuing, you know, interviewing some of these subjects, getting to get a little bit more in depth with the actual creators?
Well, you know, I'd studied literary criticism in graduate school, so I'm really interested in looking at game journalism as a way to kind of provide an idea of kind of the what's underlying the game. What are kind of the implicit elements? What's going on in terms of the background story and what the game designers were hoping to fulfill in making a certain game, or what are the connections between games? Because these are all the avenues that are explored in literary criticism in looking at the relationship between texts. As far as futurism in video games go, I like to look at video games as kind of a natural progression of the arts in terms of incorporating technology and finding a way to tell stories, create characters, create narratives, while also allowing for an interactive experience, which is, you know, provided through a technological medium. The futurism stuff, which I write about for a site called Accelerating Future, that's all about emerging technologies, and I consider video games to be kind of an emerging art form.
Is that something that you would have considered it, you know, it's kind of hard to almost look back retrospectively on it, but
yeah.
Is that something that you would have even considered back in the NES days, or did it kind of take maybe the mid-90s when they started kind of dabbling in VR, yeah, and that kind of those kind of elements? Is that when you would say video games started kind of crossing over into your interest in futurism?
In terms of my own personal experience, yeah, I wasn't cognizant of any of these connections. I was really just responding to what excited me, and playing a game I found to be, you know, much more interesting than, say, watching television, because it was more passive. I've had kind of discoveries and epiphanies over time where I say, oh, my interest in artificial intelligence or biotechnology has some kind of overlap with my interest in video game music or that kind of thing. So it's gradual that, you know, one discovers why it is that, you know, you're interested in certain things. It definitely didn't happen all at once that I realized what it was that I found interesting and where I could go to pursue other subject matter that I found to be really fascinating.
Hey, excellent. And now, kind of, you know, not. I don't think it'll like blow, you know, your secrets or anything like that. You know, I don't really think many game music journalists have, you know, the skill set that you offer, you know, in terms of, you know, knowing Japanese and kind of having your connections. But I mean, so if someone else wants to get started interviewing video game music personalities, and obviously you go deeper than that, and you've interviewed several other professionals in the industry. But how did you initially go about trying to get in contact with people and then kind of building your collective, your network of people that you've been able to interview?
Well, I am secretive sometimes in talking about interviews that are underway, because sometimes it takes a really long time, and I don't like to tell people, you know, look forward to this interview unless I know that it's definitely going to happen and mm-hmm. it's coming soon. I was just talking to Kyle about this interview that's going to come out soon with Takenobu Mitsuyoshi, and I think that one on the Daytona USA series will probably be
you know, Kyle is going to be all over that one.
That's why I asked about it.
Yeah.
That'll be online, I think, around the time that this program airs. Yeah, there's certain projects that I'm working on that are maybe 3 or 4 months away from completion. And those I try not to talk about, because I don't want for people to feel disappointed when it takes forever for them to finally materialize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand
that. Yeah, but how do you go about, though, you know, making the initial contact and beginning that creative process to get that interview underway?
Well, I definitely try to attend all the industry events.
Mm-hmm.
So E3, the Tokyo Game Show, the Game Developers Conference, and PAX. Those are the big four for me. And by being there and talking to people and, you know, showing them some of the articles that I've done previously, that gives them a good indication of, you know, what kind of experience it would be like talking with me for an article for Gameset Watch.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say those are really keys. Being at the industry events is really an important part of being a game journalist that's interacting directly with game designers. Now, when it comes to writing reviews or doing news, I don't think it's particularly necessary.
Yeah.
Now, what was your first interview? Because, you know, everyone has their first, you know, obviously, yeah. You know, Kyle's been doing, you know, NGI for a while, and, you know, I've been doing Overclock Remix as well, and we've all, like, interviewed personalities in the community. What was the, you know, back when you were unproven, you know, you didn't have that body of work to point to, how did you get your first stuff put together?
It was a really good interview. It was really interesting. It was with Kari Walgren, who was the voice of Ash in Final Fantasy XII.
Mm-hmm.
She's a voice actor. She's also... She was the voice of Shelk in Dirge of Cerberus, and she did the Joan of Arc game, a lot of games.
Yeah, Rain and Tales of Symphonia. Mm-hmm. She was also in the anime Furikuri. Yeah,
that's
pretty
right.
Familiar with her work, actually. I like her. I like her voice acting. She's very good.
She's a very good actor and can do a variety of roles. And, you know, back then I was just kind of very informally contributing to Square Haven and this Square Enix fan site. And I wanted to do this conversation with someone who'd actually worked on a game. And I found that the role of voice actors was very interesting because they're really there to act as a kind of a middle ground between the reality of the player and the fantasy world, you know, in this case, Final Fantasy XII.
Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed her, and I interviewed Gideon Emery, who did the voice of Balthier in Final Fantasy XII. And I really think that both of those performances are outstanding. I think that they added a lot to the game.
And just to be clear, you know, because I'm a... You know, I never play RPGs. Did they handle English language voice acting,
yeah,
or Japanese voice acting?
Those were the English language voice, yeah, actors.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Kari, yeah, Walgren usually does the English dub side. Actually,
nice, because you know how some fans are.
That.
You know, it's just, oh, it's, you know, it's in English. Nah. Do you have a preference, Jerry, in terms of a voice acting? Which language?
I totally have that bias for the Japanese. I normally will not listen to the dub, but...
Yeah, and this is coming from someone who actually understands the Japanese language.
Yeah. That's the reason, is because I can just listen to the Japanese version. But the thing was that the translation for Final Fantasy XII was done by Alex O. Smith and Joseph Reeder. And Alex O. Smith did the Vagrant Story translation, which is generally regarded as one of the great video game localization projects. So his script is so good. He's working with writers and voice actors who really put a lot of thought into their work and are well trained and have a respect for games. And so it's a very different kind of experience than listening to a bad dub.
Yeah.
Nice, dude. Now, do you actually get much time to play games on your own?
I'm really strapped for time. I could definitely use some time.
Same here, dude. Kyle, what about you?
Me?
On the gaming level.
I've been playing some games, but not much. I do have a little bit more time than most people, I guess, but yeah.
Man, I never have time, dude. I feel bad, but, you know, I kind of feel like I'm too busy doing stuff kind of tangentially related to it, and I just don't have time.
You could still easily appreciate the the game form and game music.
So, absolutely.
I mean, you don't need to play the games to know it's good stuff.
Larry, when you do an interview for Overclocked Remix, do you listen or do you play those games before you do the interview? Like when you're interviewing David Wise, do you play those games to kind of get in the...
No, I mean, you know, obviously with something like Donkey Kong Country, I played that like a demon when I was a kid. I mean, I definitely, I played that game a lot growing up. Yeah. And, you know, interviewing someone like Grant Kirkhope, I played GoldenEye 007. Uh-huh. Not in all cases. Like, I know we interviewed Tim Wright, and I'm more familiar with Wipeout's music than actually playing the game, although I have played Wipeout HD, but he was not involved on that soundtrack. But, no, I mean, you know, it depends who the subject is. Usually I've played something of theirs and know their work. But no, I can't say that I go back, you know, and like, for example, in this day and age and play emulated games and, you know, and that kind of thing. No, usually my line of questioning, though, will come from familiarity with their work. So, you know, I think it's like you said when we kind of talked a bit earlier, not in this interview, but when we talked before on Skype, just in that usually interviews are a great medium for getting your own personal questions that you're interested in answered.
So, yeah, I try to play all the games that that I do interviews about as much as possible. I'm still trying to finish Persona 4. Which I started months ago. It's such a huge game. Not all of them I can play all the way through. The good thing about music is that, you know, you can sit down with an album and listen to it several times through and do that much quicker than you can play an entire game from start to finish.
Yeah, definitely.
That's true. That's a good advantage.
I do try to do both because... there's a lot about the game experience and the way that, you know, audio is used in a game that you can't just get from an album.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there have been some soundtracks that I've heard where I'll listen to the soundtrack and it'll be okay, but then you'll go back and play the game and you'll gain a new appreciation for the music and how it's used within the context of the game.
Definitely.
So I could definitely agree with you on that.
Yeah, I think one of the coolest experiences I had just this past weekend was hanging with Brendan Becker, Mr. Magfest, and watching him play both Metal Gear 2, Solid Snake on the MSX, and Snatcher, and seeing how the in-game music worked on that level. Just some amazing soundtracks, but really, even for an older system like the MSX, really, really awesome seeing that music in context.
Yeah, I think that process, you can also sort of apply that process to arrangements and remixes and stuff along those lines, where I've gone back, before I got into the game music scene and stuff like that, I wasn't really familiar with the Castlevania series at all, but I think after hearing some of the arrangements and remixes that have been done, and then going back and hearing that music, how it was originally composed and put into the game, sort of gives you like a new perspective and appreciation for that.
Back in the SNES days, they used to come out regularly with these arranged albums for all of the Super Nintendo soundtracks, at least for a lot of the role-playing games.
Yeah.
And you don't see that as much anymore, but it seems like, you know, fan arrangement sites like Overclocked Remix are kind of serving that purpose in giving you a number of different takes on the same game melody.
Yeah, someone make sure to, you know, give us some arranged albums to do. We will gladly do that. I think we have the dudes. We can do it. So let's kind of move ahead a little bit. Actually, now I'm coming up with stuff on the fly though. have you ever had a particularly... No. Well, you know, I'm always trying to dig for dirt.
I know.
Have you ever had a particularly bad experience with an interview subject? Not to badmouth anybody, but maybe just someone who, I guess, maybe is not used to being interviewed or wasn't sure how serious it would be. Or maybe if you want to turn it into a good story, maybe someone that maybe initially wasn't that talkative or anything like that, but as you displayed your knowledge, they kind of opened up to you a bit more.
Honestly, I haven't really had bad experiences in talking with game designers and composers. I've had bad experiences where an article has gone really well, and just the site that I was working with gave me some problems. So usually all of the difficulties are on that end. Luckily, GameSet Watch has been great, and there haven't been any conflicts. Yeah, I'm having some difficulty now because I'm talking with a game designer, and I did all this research off stuff like Wikipedia. Uh-huh. And then I started the interview and I said, so you started making games when you were 14 years old and you were a child prodigy? And I get the email back and he's like, no, that's not true. Where did you find that out? And I had this list of all these things. He was a child prodigy. He was a novelist. He started an electronic music project that was online, and it's total BS. Everything on Wikipedia is totally false.
Are you kidding me?
Oh man!
So, what? Oh jeez. So were you? I'm assuming you were. I mean, you sound already like you're like shit. I'm mortified. Yeah. Like I can't believe it.
Well, I mean, it's not like it's my fault, but
of course not.
It'll be a good opportunity to
set the record straight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Hopefully, he can go back and edit that article and fix it.
That's going to be the goal.
That's the plan
of the article.
Now, you were mentioning before, though, like, because it seems strange to me that any website would kind of be reluctant to run with the kind of interviews you're going for. Like, can you kind of clarify, like, what kind of situations have you run into where people, you know, you've gone and done the interviews maybe. But what, do they want to edit it down, or they don't find the interview interesting enough? Like, well, I mean, what are some of these situations?
Well, that's very generous. And unfortunately, certain sites haven't seen it that way. Interviews that were with high-profile musicians have disappeared from the internet, and stuff like that. That's never fun, of course. So it's good that it's good to feel like now I'm working with people that are more professional. Right now, I'm doing this series of interviews with game composers for GameSet Watch. All of those articles are being cross-posted to Gama Sutra, and that's not a site that's going to disappear anytime soon. So that's a really comforting feeling to know that. Although I've been through a lot of experiences that treated me as if my work was superfluous, that now I've finally found myself in a position where I feel, you know, like I've got good people looking out for the work that I'm doing.
We've talked about some of the influences that you've had, you know, how you've gotten into game music. We haven't really gotten into some of the specifics with some of your personal favorites, you know, and what really spoke to you, not even just earlier on, but even nowadays. Obviously, you've interviewed so many subjects, but who do you personally find, you know, with who do you personally find makes your favorite video game music? Are you cool with naming favorites, or you know, do you have those personal guys that are at the top tier for you in just the listening experience?
I mean, I've really enjoyed talking with Hiroki Kikuta about his music for Secret of Mana and Seiken Densetsu 3, Sokagi Kodelka. He's had a real impact on my appreciation for video game music.
Like you were saying, growing up, so with Kikuta, even before you knew who he was, you know, you played Secret of Mana. Was that something that really strengthen that connection for you, because you loved his stuff before you knew who he was?
Yeah, that's right. I really enjoyed the Secret of Mana original soundtrack, and I'd imported the sequel because it never came out here, Seiken Densetsu 3.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
why. Nice. Imported it.
Ooh.
I mean, that was back in the day, and I had a thing that allowed you to play Super Famicom games on your SNES.
An adapter?
Yeah, you had like an adapter that could take the different shape the cart.
Yeah, you had to, you know, back in those days, you had to get a physical thing that was plugged into the Super Nintendo, and then you then fed in the Super Famicom into that plug, and that was you know, back in the 1990s, the late 1990s, and Seiken Densetsu 3 is one that I played just over and over again, even though my Japanese was very limited at that point. I just found it a fantastic experience. Role-playing game, and the music was a large part of that.
Nice, man. Any other favorites that really stick out? Like, I know for me, I've got Tim Fallon, but Kyle, who do you have?
You know, Takenobu Mitsuyoshi, Motoi Sakuraba. I honestly don't know how to pronounce all of these guys' names, but
Jerry, do you know?
He said it earlier. I think he said it was Motoi Sakuraba.
Sakuraba, yeah.
Sakuraba, something like that.
Nice.
But yeah, he's
big
definitely
fan of Star Ocean, Kyle.
Well,
that kind of stuff.
Star Ocean's okay, but you know the Tales series, Tales of Symphonia, Fantasia.
Yeah. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, definitely some great stuff there. Also, like, you know, Jun Senua. Mostly a lot of the Sega guys.
Have you listened to Sakuraba's Valkyrie Profile 2 Silmeria soundtrack?
I have not, no.
Well, I would really be interested in hearing what you think of it, because that, for me, is kind of his progressive rock soundtrack at its best, where he's really drawing on the progressive rock in a really interesting way.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I have a live performance. He did Star Ocean and Valkyrie Profile live.
Yeah.
And that's a really great performance. I love that album personally. So, but yeah, I'm a big fan of more of the progressive rock style composers, as you are all well aware.
Nice. And Jerry, any other names that for you have really stood out among the pack?
You know, there it takes all different kinds. I mean, lately I've been talking with English language video game composers who are working on independent games, and that's something that I find really a lot of fun, talking with people like Chris Schlarb, who's doing this night game soundtrack and has a background in atmospheric ambient music. You know, it's totally different from talking with someone like Takenobu Mitsuyoshi, who's been doing arcade music for 15 years.
What would you say are the key differences in how the independent, you know, like kind of the emerging or, you know, kind of underground guys approach an interview?
Well, the difference is that it's less about the game industry and it's more about their personal experiences. And I think the diversity is really very cool. I really prefer talking with someone who's new to video games and video game music, that works with, you know, electronic music or chamber orchestra style instrumentation, to someone who comes from television and film, who's kind of doing a video game soundtrack based on, you know, the standard instrumentations for movies and television. Because the style is so set, I think, with much of the TV and movie industry.
Kind of related to that, and sorry, well, I don't want to get it too far away from, like you said, the differences in terms of the interviewing those types of musicians in the industry, but do you like the overall direction that modern game music has gone in? I know you said that, I guess,
yeah,
in a way, there's some kind of some composers kind of working more of a film score, movie score style. I guess you're feeling there's almost kind of a cookie cutter approach. So I guess what I want to know there is, what kind of balance do you feel is being hit in modern game music?
Well, the thing is, when you have fewer musicians performing at once, that to me is preferable, because if you get 50 people in a room to play music, you can't have individuality with each performer. You can't have them be spontaneous because the mind can't take in 50 spontaneous and individual musical ideas at once. So what you get in these huge recordings is, like you said, it, more often than not, it's cookie cutter, or it isn't, to me, it doesn't feel personal. It feels very impersonal, these kinds of recordings. So, you know, someone like, the arrangers, Select Start, this
right.
orchestra style, there it's just so many people playing together that you get a sense of what each of them are doing with their instrument.
Yeah, it's only six people.
Yeah, and six is a small enough group so that they each can be doing their own thing and expressing themselves individually, and you can listen to it and get a feel for the personality of the performers. So I find chamber ensembles like Echochrome, the game, which was a string quartet. If you haven't heard it, by all means, YouTube Echochrome, because it's got some really interesting string quartet music for that PlayStation Portable and PlayStation 3 game. And I did an interview with the composer of that soundtrack, who's the head of a sound studio called Noisy Croak in Japan.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask, right, so kind of related to that, how do you what's your personal opinion of something that does involve a larger collaborative effort, something like, you know, the Super Mario Galaxy soundtrack? What would you say about the live performances used within that soundtrack? Do you feel it's been successful, or do you get that vibe where feel like there's enough of an identity with the music?
Clearly it's been successful because a lot of people enjoy that music.
Do you personally find it enjoyable? Or?
For me personally, I'm much more into a chamber ensemble or an individual musician doing electronic stuff, like I Am Robot and Proud, who I just talked with. It's one guy, and he's doing electronic music, and it's very particular to his own style, which he's evolved over the course of five albums. Mm-hmm. He's bringing that to video game music. He's got a very clear musical identity. When, you know, you listen to his music, you know that it's him. You kind of get the expression. But when it's a huge orchestra, for me, a lot of times, I don't know how to write about it as well. I certainly wouldn't know how to go about expressing my appreciation for that music as well as smaller sets of musicians.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the professional concert series then that have been, you know, obviously there's, you know, Game Music Concert, you know, that series, and you know, you have like Video Games Live and Play, and
yeah, well,
you know,
Select Start, they performed at Video Games Live.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I think is remarkable about that series, is that Tommy has invited these fan arrange groups based on where they're playing to get on stage and do their thing, which I find to be really exciting. I think 8-Bit Instrumental played at one. Mm-hmm. You know, a whole bunch of these bands have played at Video Games Live.
Vertex Guy was at one. Chris Klein, he did some Contra
and Arm Cannon.
Arm Cannon's been there. It's just it's great to see those guys getting invited to these performances like that, and I think it really adds to the live shows.
Absolutely, man. And then now, and going back to the original point though, that we were getting at. Well, actually, wait. Sorry, sticking on Video Games Live and the like. I mean, the classic Japanese concerts and whatnot. Do you, you know, I'm obviously not saying you hate those performances, but I mean, do you still find an enjoyment out of those, or is it almost that you don't appreciate those as much, only because you almost come at it from a journalistic mindset. Like, you can't dissect it as easily.
That's right. Yeah. As a journalist, I can't go to a concert and talk to every musician.
Last performer, right.
Yeah. And that's what I feel compelled to do. I mean, I went to this Press Start Symphony of Games concert last year, and I heard this Wild Arms medley, and that was really exciting, and it was great to talk to Michiko Naruke, the composer, about her work for that, for RPG Fan. But the thing that about it is, I'm only talking with Michiko Naruke. I'm not talking with the conductor. I'm not talking with the dude who's whistling during the Wild Arms medley. And I'm not talking with every individual performer, so it feels like their roles are being subjugated, and that's something I prefer less, you know, than talking to every member of Select Start, which I did for an interview with this site called Forever Fantasy. It's a Final Fantasy fan site. So that, to me, is the difference, is the impersonal quality of the orchestra. While it's enjoyable as a journalist, it feels like certain people are they're not getting as much individual attention as they should.
Mm-hmm. And so now, going back to how we originally got to this tangent, which was the differences in interviewing, you know, career-long musicians versus newcomers, and then also talking about a partial summary of some of the direction of modern music. But overall, you're saying that you feel that the modern video game music industry is still pretty diverse, very solid, has a solid grounding?
I mean, it's so diverse because independent games are making their money back. A lot of them are. And that means that novel, innovative soundtracks like the Pixel Junk Monsters soundtrack, the Pixel Junk Eden soundtrack are being heard by people. The Echo Chrome soundtrack, people are listening to that and responding to it favorably, and that encourages independent game designers to take a chance and work with independent musicians. Polytron Corporation is a company that's working on this game, Fez. I don't know if you've heard about this.
No, I haven't. Kyle, have you heard of it, man?
No.
Keep your eye on Fez, F-E-Z, because it looks extraordinary. It's a little independent game, and it's got an amazing musician working on it who does a lot of electronic music and chiptune stuff. And I think that it's going to be another... I'd be very surprised if it weren't another kind of victory for independent games, the way it's looking right now. A site that does a lot of good writing on independent games and video game music for independent games, aside from Games That Watch, is Offworld, the Boing Boing spinoff.
Right.
That's a really good site to read if you're excited about indie products.
They've definitely done some good. They've definitely pimped us, you know, kind of related to some article, pimped OCR, and they've definitely, I've seen, for example, Daniel Baranowski working on some soundtracks, Flash game soundtracks, and so Offworld is definitely another good source, like you were saying.
One thing that I should mention is that one of the reasons that I'm able to conduct these interviews is that I'm working together with a team of Japanese language translators. It's not just me going out there and working on these. It's actually a team of people. I could have made that a bit clearer, but if you actually read the interviews themselves, you'll find that Ryojiro Sato, who's a professional translator and a musician and knows a lot about games, we work together on quite a few of these articles, and that accounts for the high quality not only the English language draft, but the Japanese language one at all as well. Something I don't really understand is, in a lot of these interviews, what only gets posted is the English language version, right?
Right, yeah, even though they've translated it, right? Yeah.
Right, so if you're going to go into an interview with the assumption that this is someone whose opinion is and perspective is really significant, why you would then say, you know, thank you for joining us for this discussion, we're going to now ditch your original words and chuck them in the trash and just post the translation. That to me, I don't understand the rationale behind it. Mm-hmm. So something that's been important to me in doing interviews is whenever I can, whenever I have permission to do so, I always post the Japanese language version either on my own site or on an outside site, so that it's accessible to video game music fans in Japan. Mm-hmm. And working with people to find out when there's an opportunity for a French language version. I work together with someone named Jeremy a lot, who's a really gifted writer who knows a lot about Square Enix music and video game music in general. Mm-hmm. Russian sites, Italian sites. I've worked with Portuguese sites. Whenever they're receptive to the idea of a collaboration, that's something that I really like to be involved in, so that it's a really a cross-cultural discussion of video game music.
Can you maybe throw in some quick pimps for what you're working on, where fans can go to read your works, your interviews, and get to see more of what you're working on?
About a year ago, a friend of mine named Waleed, who lives in Mountain View, which is not far from the Google headquarters, we were looking at a way of creating a site that would be useful to people who liked video game music. That could be kind of a resource, like, you know, VGMDB is a very useful resource for people, or Overclocked Remix is great for arrangements, or Game Music for All has good information on video game inspired music. And he created a site called the Zoob Network, which was a collection of these dig style websites for niche communities. And I thought that the size of the video game music community was really just the right size, so that you could have a few posts each day about video game music, and it wouldn't be too much for people to absorb and sift through. We set up this site so that it would be functional, so that people could vote on the posts they like, and there could be some kind of an interactive component to the website. So that's called Nobuo, and it's nobuoo.com. And the reason it's named that is, you know, I could have gone with something like VGM News or VGM Feed, but I thought that would sound like too many of the websites that already exist. And I was thinking in terms of, like, you know, what are the really useful tools that are online? They're search engines like Google and Yahoo. It's things like tweeting on Twitter. And they all sound kind of like half like real words and half like just kind of like baby gibberish, like baby babble.
Yeah, they're just made up words.
Yeah, and I thought Nobuo kind of had that quality of kind of like a baby babble, but people know that this is the name of the guy who did the Final Fantasy music, so it seemed to have kind of the right ring to it. And it was short. It didn't have too many letters, and the domain was open. So that's what Waleed and I chose. And it's gotten really good feedback. Once a month, we make a video which involves discussions with people who are bloggers, podcasters, remixers, or video game composers. And the most recent installment that's been posted was a video interview with the Tenshu composer, Nodiyuki Asakura, which is available in English and French, the subtitles. And that's been a project that's been a lot of work, but it's been very meaningful, I feel, to be a part of this experiment. Larry, you were on the show talking about Super Street Fighter II HD Remix.
Exactly.
And Malkos, and his Stephen Malcolm Howell's amazing music.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and you really reach across and really get a lot of different people communities. Yeah. Like you've had random, you know, Mega Randoms.
Had
a lot of other game music journalists as well.
Yeah, Ken Lee of Into the Score, which is an academic video game podcast, and he's done episodes on Overclocked Remix.
Mm-hmm.
Game Music for All, Dr. Octorok of 8-Bit Jesus, the Holiday Chiptune album. He was on the show, and quite a few higher plane music. Recently, we've been looking more at video game composers. The next installment that's coming up is going to be on the Game Developers Conference, and that's going to take a look at Pixel Junk Eden a bit. So having a kind of a balance between what people are doing in terms of appreciation of video game music and actually talking with composers who are creating games that are and game soundtracks that are out there, that's kind of what the series is aiming for. You don't see too much of that in video. It's really more in text, which is, of course, my background.
I think video helps.
What
make
about
it a little
also
more.
Like, you know, since we're in pimp mode, can you pimp a little bit more? You know, just once again for the listeners out there, what you're working on, for example, with Game Set Watch. You know, how can they look for that?
Well, those don't have a set schedule, so it is pretty difficult to find those if you're just browsing. I mean, you can search for Jerry Aska on Game Set Watch or Gamma Sutra.
Mm-hmm.
All of the posts on Game Set Watch have ended up on Gamma Sutra, so that's one way of finding it. Going to Nobuo, subscribing to the RSS feed, or following Nobuo on Twitter is a good way to find a whole bunch of stuff that's happening on video game music.
All right, cool. And as you mentioned there, that's Nobuo, Nobuo.com.
Yep.
And look for that on Twitter as well. All right, man. So, there were a couple more questions I wanted to get at, and then obviously, you know, there were some stuff that you wanted to cover. You know, obviously, Nitro Game Injection, you know, we're big on, you know, not just the professional game music albums out there, but obviously, you know, the arrangement community as well. You've mentioned that in the past you've interviewed Malkos, you know, Stephen Malcolm Howell.
That's right.
Who, you know, is with OC Remix, and he worked on Super Street Fighter II Turbo HD Remix. What are some other, and obviously, you know, with your Japanese language background, you have access to other scene, you know, the Japanese scene as well, that's not, you know, outside what you can really take an in-depth look at. What are some other great acts that you've enjoyed, other artists or whatnot that you've enjoyed in the fan community?
Well, Stephen Malcolm Howell is definitely up there. I really enjoy his Sega arrangements on Overclock Remix. I found those to be extremely rewarding to listen to. I think another soundscape does amazing work, and I've really enjoyed talking with him online and listening to his Cheetahmen 2 arrangements. Really cool. I'm glad that was on the Nitro Game injection podcast. Select Start, like I've mentioned, they've done really good work in the past. In terms of Japan, there's someone named Hyodyne, who's kind of like a star of Nico Nico Doga.
Right. Yeah, he's done some arrangements. He's also done some original track, you know, like the Street Fighter one, original tracks just based on the games.
That's right. The Nobuo video that you were on, Larry, was kind of a Street Fighter special.
Right.
And, we talked about Malkos, and we also talked about Hyodyne's original song, The World Warriors. And I'd interviewed Hyodyne for Silicon Era. I think it's his only English language interview to date. Mm-hmm. And he is really incredible because he does all these vocal tracks where he sings these songs over classic game themes and gives them lyrics. And he does all the voices for all these characters, including the women.
So right.
He does these great female impersonations of people like Chun-Li. And that's someone that, if you're into video game music and you haven't heard of him, Googling Hyadain is pretty fun.
Awesome, man. And when did you first become aware of the fan scene? I mean, obviously you were studying Japanese. Did you run into that more on the Japanese side? Or how did you first hear of fans going ahead and doing their own interpretations?
I'd been listening to Overclocked Remix for a long time. I remember when Terra and Black came out.
Wow.
But that was, back then I wasn't writing about games. That was a continuation of my interest in listening to video game music as part of surviving school. I'd listened to OCR for a really long time. Of course, that was much more accessible than the doujin scene in Japan, which I'm not all that familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But someone named Deku Bar, who runs a site in Japan called Dekunology, introduced me to a lot of Nico Nico Doga stuff and Hatsune Miku videos, that kind of thing.
You sat down with the Tenchu composer as your most recent video in the Nobu video series. What can you tell us about how it was to talk with the guy who worked on the Tenchu music?
It was a very rewarding experience for me because this interview for Game Set Watch has been made available in four languages. It's in English, Japanese, French, and Russian. And I think it's really appropriate to this particular soundtrack because even though the game itself is set in 16th century Japan, where there wasn't a lot of culture outside of Japan itself influencing the music, the soundtrack to the game itself is very diverse in terms of the instrumentation and the melodies, and that was all a stylistic decision that was made by the composer Noriyuki Asakura. And this is something that I really learned in sitting down and talking with him for this interview, which is now in text and also a Nobuo video.
You know, I liked his stuff, and this is kind of almost like a kind of stuff on the down low that most people maybe didn't enjoy as much. But I liked a lot of the work that he did on the Capcom Fighting Jam soundtrack, Capcom Fighting Evolution. So I mean, that's definitely cool that you got to interview him on the Tenchu series, and watching the Nobuo video with that, some of that music was really creepy.
It's very emotionally effective, I find. I'm not familiar with his Capcom work, but he did the soundtracks for Tenchu 1 through 4, and then there's been some spin-offs that he wasn't involved in, but for the main installments of the games, he's done the music.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very progressive sound.
Yeah, I was gonna say for anyone that's not too familiar with it, what can you say about his style in general for the Tenchu series?
Well, the way that Kyle put it, I'd say is accurate. That it's progressive style music. He's using some of the ideas that came out of progressive rock. And he's using that as a kind of structural component on which to organize all of these different instruments. You know, traditional Japanese instruments like the shinobue and the koto and the shamisen. Also Chinese instruments and melodies, Thai stuff and Turkish instruments. He's using the Arabic scale. So he's bringing in all of these diverse traditions that haven't interacted with each other, and then trying to make something that's an organic synthesis of those. And what he's doing basically to organize the rules of his compositions is this progressive style, which is very familiar to video game players, because people like Sakuraba, people like Uematsu, and a lot of others have been really deeply influenced by progressive rock. In fact, when I was talking with Kikuta of Secret of Mana, he told me that when he was called in for his first interview for Square, he sat down and Kenji Ito and Nobuo Uematsu were in the room, and they just listened to his demo reel. And the first thing they asked was, "So, you like prog rock, huh?" And Kikuta said, "Yeah, I kind of do." And, you know, they were talking about progressive rock and Japanese musicians that were kind of using that for their music. And the interview ended, and Kikuta went back home. And he never expected to hear back from them. But when he did, and when he was hired to compose for Secret of Mana, what he realized is it was that connection to prog rock that really kind of made it so these musicians felt that they could work together.
Nice, dude. And progressive rock, I mean, yeah, I've obviously, you know, for any fans of, say, Dream Theater, or there's some people in our community, you know, like Christian Picot, Kay Triton, Norg as well. You know, Norg, I can think of Kyle. I'm sure you can think of some dudes. It's a very it's a very energetic, really it's a very creatively fertile style. I mean, and you really pack in a lot of ideas in a short amount of time, given what you can work with.
That's definitely true.
I think the thing about progressive rock is that it's a very open-ended style. There's no limit to really what you can do with progressive music. That's why it's called progressive.
Go ahead.
It involves a lot of modulation. You can kind of change the mood of the music very abruptly without jarring the listener. And that was, I think, really important for video games, where you're moving, like in Final Fantasy IV, you're moving from a love scene to a fight scene to, you know, now we're resting in a very short period of time. Knowing how to handle those transitions in a way that wasn't jarring was really effective for early role-playing games.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, like, kind of the progressive style, is that a favorite genre of yours, you know, overall within video game music?
Well, I was talking with Vincent Diamante, the composer of Flower, and his argument is that, like, basically all of the NES composers were really strongly influenced by that style, whether they realized it or not. There were very few that were working outside of competence in that area, and so it's kind of like this overarching influence for the very early stuff. Other people have more of a kind of an orchestral background. I know that Yoko Shimomura of Kingdom Hearts, she has an orchestral background. Dragon Quest is very orchestral.
Definitely.
I think there's some other modes as well that you know, there's techno, of course, but progressive rock is extremely influential, I think, across the board.
Kind of related to that, right? So you were saying, in terms of Asakura, you're only really familiar with his work on Tenshu?
Yeah, he'd done Rurouni Kenshin, the anime. He'd done this PlayStation game called Crime Crackers. But Tenshu, for me, is the one series that I really associate with Asakura. And the first game, when it came out, really had a strong impact on me. Just the atmosphere of that, that stage one music, where you're infiltrating the headquarters of this merchant, and it's at night, and you're ducking through the shadows. The use of the percussion and the live instruments I found to really set the mood in a way that it was just a little different and more involving than I'd seen in other games.
The Tenchu series, it's not, I wouldn't say it's too well known in the North American side. Why do you think that might be? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a game that really took off here compared to, say, Metal Gear Solid.
I always ask myself that when there's a game that I really like that isn't adopted either in Japan or in Western territories. Like, for instance, the Yakuza series, I think, is really interesting. You know, there are all of these RPGs that are very, very similar. They all take place in this kind of, you know, medieval fantasy realm, and Yakuza is an action RPG that draws on the mythos and things surrounding organized crime in Japan, and that and Tenchu, the people that are making these games have a deep understanding of, you know, what it was historically to be a ninja, what it was historically to be a Yakuza, and it might be just too difficult for casual players to catch up with all of that background. Something might be lost in translation. That's my only guess, because they're very interesting games. The subject matter is pretty deep.
You were talking about how the Tenchu series is kind of, you know, underappreciated, you know, and yeah, maybe to some extent, and slightly less accessible maybe for Western audiences. Can you think of an example, though? I mean, obviously, you know, we know, like, Final Fantasy and that kind of stuff that has really been, I guess, welcomed with open arms on this side. But maybe what are some other great soundtracks that you feel fall in the realm of that, the instance of Tenchu, where, I mean, this is some great music, but you feel like, you know, you kind of wonder why the game maybe didn't take off as much. And do correct me if I'm wrong about the popularity of some of these things. But for example, I can think of something like, you know, maybe like Phantasy Star Online or Zone of the Enders, that kind of stuff, where, you know, obviously those do have some recognition, but maybe not as hot, per se, as hot a property as Final Fantasy or Chrono Trigger or some of these other Eastern ideas that have come over to the West.
Well, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of there being really good music for a game that's not very good. And then it's easy to understand why no one knows about, say, Sokaigi or Del Toro Quest. It's because people were critical about the game, and for good reason. But the soundtrack is awesome. You know, it's always unfortunate when that happens. You would prefer that, you know, the bad music always gets paired with the bad game and vice versa.
Right.
In terms of underappreciated music and underappreciated games, I mean, I think there are plenty of those. And cultural differences are sometimes one of the reasons for that. I mean, the Pixel Junk series isn't very well known in Japan. That may have changed with Eden, but in the West it's done okay, which is why Q Games has been able to progress. But I think the music for Pixel Junk Monsters gets less recognition than it could. It's getting a PSP port, so maybe more people will discover it. But I think that's an incredible soundtrack by Odegram.
I love the Pixel Junk Eden soundtrack, and that game is, well, that game is tough. I will, you know, definitely.
Oh, I like the game a lot. Bion's work for Pixel Junk Eden is pretty extraordinary, both in the music and in the art direction. I think that's been a success in terms of receptiveness to that game. It seems like to me, it seems like the Pixel Junk series is just really picking up steam, and they just premiered the first video for the fourth installment.
Well, what's the theme for that?
The new one, the theme is kind of subterranean exploration. You're in a ship and you're digging underground in these caves, and there's these avalanches of lava that you're avoiding, and you're trying to rescue these little guys in this two-dimensional, this 2D underground landscape. It looks pretty cool.
Excellent. And let me, and I know, you know, earlier on you mentioned it's hard for you to predict when, you know, certain interviews, certain projects that you're working on will come out. So I know that we can't kind of hold you to like, oh, what can we, you know, what is absolutely coming out, you know, in the next couple of months. But just, you know, to give maybe people a little bit of a preview, what can you talk about? I know you mentioned Pixel Junk Eden coverage in Nobuo. What else can you talk about that you can let the people know about?
Pixel Junk Monsters. There's going to be a video interview with Odegraph on Nobuo. As soon as I hear back from Q Games, they've already approved the installment on Pixel Junk Eden.
Okay.
So stuff will be posted on that. Daytona USA, there's going to be that.
Kyle is more excited once again.
That should be.
Get away!
That should be fun. I've been invited to the Monster Hunter 5th Anniversary Orchestral Concert that's happening in Tokyo.
Oh man, so that's pretty badass, dude.
Gonna be doing some reportage for that.
Oh my god. Yeah, I'll go with you though, man.
That's awesome. Take me with you too.
That's right, man. Take us with you. Pay for our tickets. Give us a limousine. And then maybe we'll go. You know, maybe you'll have us, you know, VIPs there.
Are you guys planning on being at PAX, at any arcade expo? Is that a possibility?
Kyle, what about you, man? You going, man? West Coast, man. Now you're in California, so you're kind of in that range.
I'm not sure.
That's going to be
I would love to go, but right now I'm having a hard enough time paying for basic necessities, much less...
I feel you.
Much less going to conventions. I would love to go. I
feel you.
Would love
to
go
to PAX,
E3,
man. I'm working on it.
E3, PAX, MAGFest. I would love to go to all of those.
Oh, yeah, dude. At least come to MAGFest, dude. Jerry, you too, man. Go to MAGFest. I mean, because you've been to the DC area doing some futurist stuff, so that's not totally that's not out of the neck of the woods, man. Reagan National, there's shuttles that go right to the hotel, directly from Reagan National, man. So I mean, you got no excuse, man. It's New Year's unless you're covering something else.
I was in Arlington for AGI09. New Year's is a possibility. 2010. That's incredible. It's going to be 2010, huh?
Yeah, dude. Space Odyssey.
No, that's 2001, Larry.
Ah, shit! I've got my ones and my zeros confused, man. Yeah, right, 2001 Space Odyssey. All right. So we kill me in my lack of it. There's a reason I like video game soundtracks and not film scores, because I'm totally out of my depth on film scores and films and pop culture and life and everything. So, But no, MAGFest, dude. It'll be the 8th one, man. So, you know, they're doing it bigger and better every year, bro.
That's exciting.
But yeah, you were mentioning PAX. Did you have any particular plans that you had for PAX already? Or maybe you can't go into detail on that. But so basically just more of the same? Looking into some interviews?
I'm going to be at PAX, and that's a really kind of exciting event for anyone who's into independent games, because what they do at PAX is they pick 10 games, and it's called the PAX 10. And basically, they're these indie games that haven't come out yet, and they're developers that could really use the encouragement of, you know, a huge event like the Penny Arcade Expo. And you go there, and these 10 games are on the show floor, and standing there right next to the game is the guy or the team or the gal who created this game. And you can talk to them about their time making it. And so for someone who's an aspiring video game journalist, it's a really good experience, and people are totally open to talking about their stuff, and you can get an exclusive scoop for your blog. So that's something that I would really encourage people that have the opportunity to attend, is to check out the PAX 10.
Absolutely. And let me ask, do you know how they go about the selection process of the PAX 10? I mean, they just kind of submit it, and the organizers decide which 10 games, or do fans vote on the games? And any idea how they put that together?
Yeah, they have a panel of 50 judges. So it's
wow.
And these are not any old person. These are industry experts that are selected by the Penny Arcade organization to decide which of these games are the most fun, the most inspired. And I was there last year, and man, it was 10 great games. They were really good. Stuff like The Maw, which is on Xbox Live Arcade.
Mm-hmm.
Audio Surf, which is an extraordinary game. Sushi Bar Samurai, which I just did an interview on. A lot of really cool stuff. So, and the people they get to judge for the judges really, really know games and game design. So there, a lot of thought and effort is put into the PAX 10.
Oh, wow, that's excellent. So, like you're saying, seems like a great spotlight, a really, certainly an attraction that people really need to be paying attention to as something that's integral to the PAX experience.
Yeah, and definitely something that's great for aspiring journalists who can make it to the event, because if you want to build a portfolio, you want to build a resume and show people that you know how to write about games, it's a great place to go to talk to game designers.
Exactly. It's a great way to cut your teeth on the putting that together. Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, man. So it's as we talked about in the past, you definitely have a full plate in terms of what you're working on, both with the futurist coverage that you give and the video game music. So, obviously you have your downtime, but you're very, very busy kind of, hitting these events and giving that coverage.
Yeah, like I think all three of us, we've all got a lot going on, and we're all wearing quite a few hats. So,
I'm wearing about four right now. I gotta be all like super secretive about what I'm working on, which sucks. But I've got about four or five hats on at the same time. It's getting wild, man.
That's right.
So that is awesome. But I am hoping to go to PAX. Let me go to PAX. Give me some PAX. And what about E3 is coming up sooner, man. You're rolling at that, right?
Yeah. I'm going to be at E3. It was undecided for a while, but I heard back both from E3 and PAX that they have a media pass for me, so I'll be providing coverage for that.
Excellent. Did you attend E for All? Did you have any opinions on that? Or
I don't know E for All. I haven't attended it, so I couldn't tell you.
Okay, but is this wouldn't be your first E3 though, would it?
No, I've been to several E3s previously, both the industry E3, the thing that happened last year. I don't know what you would call it. Oh, it's called a business summit now.
Right.
Yeah.
I've been to the business summit and the much business more summit. The much more fun and participatory battle royale E3 that happened in the old days. I was at that as well.
Oh wow!
Yeah, those were a lot more legendary.
Used to be incredible.
Used to be.
Yeah, well, now it's not the same kind of thing where there's just, you know, hundreds of people, you know, and all of these kiosks. It's not. It's just not the same event anymore. But they're saying this year a lot's going to be unveiled. It's looking like Sony's got something up their sleeve.
Yeah, they're trying to kind of tap into the old flavor again. I think they're trying to hit a happy medium. I think they realize they swung too far in the conservative direction in terms of how many people could attend and what the presentations would look like. Obviously, Booth Babes was a big deal for some people. And so now I'm sure once you attend E3, I guess you'll be able to report back on how you feel this modified experience would look like.
I get the sense that it's still kind of business oriented more so than that's something that makes PAX a lot of fun, because it's meant to be an enjoyable event, not necessarily a business meeting.
Right, and ironically enough, you know, as I'm sure you can attest to, when E3 tried to scale it back and have more of the quote-unquote business approach, they ended up losing people, businesses, actual companies attending the event.
Yeah,
it's less fun, so who wants to be there?
Exactly. So, and maybe the last thing I wanted to hit when you were talking about PAX, can you go a little bit more into, you know, obviously you brought up the PAX 10 as a great feature of the event, and you're saying it's not as business oriented, yet we're seeing such a huge explosion in terms of the official representation that happens at PAX. Where do you feel PAX has been setting the right tone, per se, compared to something like E3 when they were attempting to go for the E for All approach?
Well, Gabe and Tycho have such a kind of good relationship with the fans of Penny Arcade, the people who support Penny Arcade. They're able to create an environment that's really accessible and fun for people, and there's nothing like that going on at E3, really. PAX, just the entire atmosphere was really enjoyable. You have people like Will Wheaton, who are around, who's a really cool guy. You had Onomatoguchi playing on stage. I mean, E3 would never come up with the idea of inviting Onomatoguchi to perform live on stage. It's just totally out of step with the whole business summit agenda of the event.
Yeah, and you could almost argue that they're not really in tune with that kind of stuff.
No, it's not the purpose. The purpose is to unveil projects for developers and the press. And there's definitely some good stuff that comes out of PAX in terms of game, the unveiling of games. I think that's where PAX 10 is really crucial. The independent side of the Penny Arcade Expo.
It definitely, it gives them an opportunity to lift up other titles, you know what I'm saying? And because they're almost in a sense, right, you know, Penny Arcade are kingmakers of sorts. You know, they can they can really make a project for you and give it that spotlight. So and that's something that E3, and that's no offense to E3 because they're there to spotlight, you know, the established companies, but this is something that Penny Arcade has a leg up on.
I think the Maw might not have found its as much of
an audience
had it not been selected as part of that. And a lot of these games, like
AudioSurf as well, man. AudioSurf is huge now.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's entirely due to PAX, but some of these games you would never hear about were they not selected for the PAX 10, and they're awesome games. I hope they all get distribution through some method or another. There's more and more, you know, avenues for independent games to gain distribution these days, which is really exciting. And it's great for video game musicians, because people who have really innovative, very different approaches, they don't have to go through, you know, this process of going to some large company and modifying their approach so that it's mainstream. They can find some quirky indie game development company to work with and make it happen.
Awesome, man. And then kind of the I have like 80 last questions. I like the
Kyle, yeah. That's how you always roll, Larry.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's you know, we got Jerry on, he's given some really good insight.
Yeah.
And now, you know, and I like how you mentioned how these independent titles can give additional opportunities to aspiring video game musicians.
That's right.
And yet, you know, you do have also, you have really cool stuff happening in the more mainstream stuff.
Uh-huh.
How would you say, I guess, what would you say results in video game soundtracks for larger properties, you know, for these larger companies sounding like they have a unique approach when, as you mentioned, sometimes approaches have to be modified and it's not quite maybe what the artist originally intended. So where do you see the formula working where you let the artist have a majority of control and influence in that direction and then turning out a good product? I mean, how often would you say that does happen in the higher levels of the video game music industry?
It happens very infrequently, the bigger the budget, because if you've got a huge budget, you can't really justify approaches that haven't been tested. You need to have a market-tested product, the bigger your budget is, because no company wants to lose a lot of money and have their employers, not have a source of revenue. So it's really in the smaller games, in the independent games, where it makes more sense to be really experimental, because they want to grab people's attention, they want to be different, whereas, you know, big budget games, really there's an incentive to be a tested product that you've seen before and that's familiar.
Right. And I would argue, and I think you both you and Kyle might agree, is that, you know, for example, you know, Jerry, you recently did the interview with Hideyuki Fukasawa for Street Fighter IV, and, you know, you interviewed the Street Fighter IV sound team. Those soundtracks, would you say they are more of the exception than the rule in terms of how, like you're saying, a big budget project can really speak with a unique voice?
Well, half the songs on the Street Fighter IV soundtrack are, of course, arrangements of Street Fighter 2.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but those themes are heard very infrequently in the game compared to the original stage themes that are present.
That's
so I guess maybe thinking more on that level, you know, creating those themes, would you say that something like, say, Street Fighter 4, that's an exception more than in the rule in terms of how a big budget soundtrack can still have a very unique flavor?
I think that there's definitely innovation that happened on the Street Fighter IV audio side, and I talked with Endo-san and Fukasawa-san for that interview, so there's some information for those who wanted to look into that. I'd say it's less mind-blowing than something like Patapon or Katamari Damacy or Chrome. In terms of the length to which it struggles to be different. But there's definitely very cool stuff. You really have to strike a balance in a game like Street Fighter IV between innovation and doing something that's familiar to Street Fighter fans so they don't find themselves alienated. Are you finding on Overclocked Remix that you have a lot of people that are interested in arranging Street Fighter 4 the same way they were interested in Street Fighter 2, for instance?
No, but I think it's harder, you know, because I think there's always going to be, at least for the foreseeable future, there's always going to be more interest in arranging 8 and 16-bit soundtracks because they're more expandable. And, you know, and the instrumental sets are less defined. So it's those ideas and those melodies are more malleable in terms of, you know, taking them in other directions. Whereas you have something like Street Fighter 4, and I think actually Street Fighter 4 is a stronger example in a modern soundtrack of newer soundtracks that have strong melodies. And, you know, you mentioned Katamari Damacy as well. That's another great example. I'm hoping that in the next, you know, and hopefully OCR will be around in that capacity, but, you know, like, let's say in the next 5 years, that you would see more stuff from soundtracks that really stand out in the, you know, the PlayStation 2, you know, Wii and you know, that the Xbox kind of era. But I think always there's going to be more of a focus on the oldest titles, especially now they're given new life with the Virtual Console and, you know, yeah, Xbox Live Arcade and PSN.
Are you at all interested in encouraging people to remix more contemporary recent video game music by, for instance, shifting the attention of a compilation toward a more recent game? Is that something that you've looked at or discussed?
I don't know. I mean, Kyle, you know, Kyle can definitely speak of the direction that projects go in, and that I guess it's just whatever the community wants, right, Kyle?
Yeah. Well, with the recent Summoning of Spirits project that was released on OCR, I was directing that, and with that project, we were looking at the soundtrack for Tales of Symphonia, which is
on the GameCube.
Which is a very recent example of a game soundtrack, and it is. A little bit more defined, more so than the older 16 and 8-bit soundtracks.
Yeah, it's just the sonic palette was a lot wider.
Yeah, so it was, but we still managed to get enough people together for this album project. We also covered Tales of Phantasia, but enough people together to cover Tales of Symphonia, which is a newer game. So I think that with newer games, if you try to take an arrange album or a project like that in a direction where you're looking at newer games, I think it's possible to do that. So I could see a Street Fighter 4 project, for example, working out.
Yeah, and I think, it's almost, there's almost a conundrum there in that I know some people are working on a Mega Man 9 soundtrack, and that's new, but that's not modern. Those are modern sounds.
Yeah.
I think up until this point, I think with Kyle's project with Summoning of Spirits, I think Tales of Symphonia is the most recent game ever covered in an OC Remix project. So I think that shows you where the focus lies. You know, there's only so much we can do in terms of directing, per se, people to do it. Because really, we've just left the community up to their own devices, and they deliver in a big way. So I think honestly, it'll probably be several years until we see a sort of sea change, if you will, with covering stuff that's more recent. And I think it's always going to be more difficult to cover music that's more recent, or at least that's more modern. So anything kind of mid-90s and onward with the CD-based games, I think, are going to be more difficult when there's less of a melodic focus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of, you know, that's going off on that tangent.
There's still some
great stuff.
There's a lot of music for the Nintendo DS that is still in the same vein of the 16-bit and 32-bit era.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen some, we do have some stuff from the Phoenix Wright series. We have at least one mix from Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, and New Super Mario Brothers, and we actually just approved, we already approved a few months ago, a second one from Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, and I just approved one from, a second one from New Super Mario Brothers. So we are seeing a little bit more of that coverage, and like you're saying, the platforms that still encourage maybe an older brand of video game music creation, those should definitely prove fertile ground in the coming years for in terms of stoking the creative fires of the community. Maybe I think the last thing I would say, right, the last thing that we'll have you hook up for the listeners, and you can go in any direction you want for it, but there's so many awesome game soundtracks, and obviously NGI doesn't have time to cover them all, even you don't have time to cover them all, but maybe give maybe three or four, hell, go as many as you want, video game soundtracks that you heavily encourage any fan of video game music to check out. Give us some recommendations.
Okay. Check out Flower. It's by Vincent Diamante, and it's a PlayStation 3 game. And the soundtrack for that will be coming out soon, I believe. But if it's not out by the time this airs, check out the game or check out Diamante's soundtrack for Cloud, which is another game by Genova Chen and that game company. Mm-hmm. Another one that I would recommend is Cave Story. That's a freeware game that came out years ago by a Japanese game designer named Pixel, and that's being redone for WiiWare and should be out very soon. That's being published by Nicalis, and that has some really interesting music in there. Night Game is another game by Nicalis, and Chris Schlarb is the composer. I talked about that very briefly, but that's looking very interesting. The Pixel Junk Monsters and Pixel Junk Eden soundtracks are great by Autograph and Bion. And if those interest you, you can find out all sorts of information about new video game music and arrangements that are coming out on Nobuo, N-O-B-U-O-O-O. So that's where you can find some stuff. Also, Overclocked Remix and VGMDB are great resources. So, you know, hopefully a few of those sites together can really get anyone who's interested in learning more about video game music up to speed with what's happening these days.
Excellent, man. So I feel like I learned a lot. I hope that the listeners did as well. You know, yeah, Jerry, man, you're doing some good work. You're definitely working hard to help educate, you know, more video game fans and more music listeners out there to check out what's going on. Not just the classic stuff, you know, that most people are familiar with, but getting people more in the modern stuff that's taking place right now.
Yeah, as are you guys, definitely.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and thank you for thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This has been Nitro Game Injection. We're here with Jerry Aska. If you want to check out his stuff, he's at nobuo.com. And he also has posted his interviews on Game Set Watch and Gamma Sutra. We'll, of course, have the links for all that in the show notes. So that's
going to
be it.
Yeah, just make sure to Google Jerry Aska interview, man, for just a whole breadth of content that, you know, maybe it's not all in the same place, you know, as you know, just throughout his career. So there's tons of stuff all around the net. And obviously, you know, Game Set Watch, Gamma Sutra, the weapon of choice right now. Mm-hmm. For some great interviews.
All right, we've been here with Jerry Aska. Thanks for being on. Don't forget to hit us up online, kngi.org. Hit us up on our podcast alley. Go there, vote for us. Make sure to just go to kngi.org. We've got a link there right on the front page for podcast alley. Hit that, and then click vote. Type in your email address, and then vote now. And then just confirm it. Because we need those votes
so we can
be popular. Because we want to be popular.
That's what everybody wants.
Yes. And also, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. You can hit us up on our Facebook group and fan page. We are on MySpace. And, of course, Twitter. Either follow me, KyleJCRB, or Larry OG. And you'll get the latest updates direct from us. Regarding the show. And of course, you can email us, kngipodcast@gmail.com. and give us a call. Leave your voicemail message at 1-763-431-5121. Haven't been getting much use of that lately, guys, so come on, give us your calls. Let us know.
I want requests.
Yes.
I definitely want requests.
Yes. Request something, or just, you know, tell us about your upcoming thing, or just say, hey guys, you suck. Or anything like that. It don't really matter. So.
What? I'm going to veto that, dude. We're not going to play that.
know. Why not?
If it's funny. It's got to be praise for the wonderful service that we are providing to the video game music community.
Okay. If it's funny, though, we'll play it. So, thanks, everyone. And we are out. This is Kyle JCRB.
Larry OG.
And we're gone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Going now?
Yes.
Where are you going?
I'm leaving.
Going potty?
No. I'm recording.
I thought you were going potty. This seemed to be pretty apparent. No, all right. Okay, I wasn't sure, man. Come on, man. I had to clarify, you know. You can't leave it ambiguous like that. You left it all up in the air, or yeah. You know, down in the bowl, as it were.
So.
I just wasn't sure. Come on, man. I wasn't sure.
You know what I was talking about. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm recording.
Well, you're laughing, dude. We can't be ready to go, man. I need to be in the moment.
All right, I'm ready.
All right, ready. Ah, he's a pooping.